cursing. He wants the Balaam Eitzah that will cause the Jewish people to fall out of favor with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bilam's Eitzah is Shel Elu Seinei Zima, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu hates promiscuity. By the way, Zima has a double meaning in this context. Zima means to turn away, so it both refers to idolatry, turning away from Hashem, and it also refers to adultery and etc. And therefore, Bilam tells Balak to have the daughters of Moab, as it were, dress up and be machshil of Bnei Yisrael. Now here's a very interesting point. The daughters of Moab, as far as we read, didn't protest this at all. They went ahead and did it. And there was a tremendous magefa, there was a plague, and 24,000 Jews died in that plague. Rashi points out later in Pinchas, although we don't know for sure, he hypothesizes, he speculates, Rashi says he doesn't know, that a majority of those who died were from the tribe of Shimon, just as the Nasi that Pinchas killed. And Rashi proves this because if you look right after the Maaseh, the Jewish people are counted again, and if you compare the census in Pinchas with the census at the beginning of Bamidbar, now of course the Bamidbar census are the Jews who left Egypt. The census in Pinchas are the Jews who came to Eretz Yisrael. Most of the Shvatim are approximately the same. But with Shevet Shimon, there's like a 30,000 decrease. Just look at the numbers. In other words, I'll give you the exact number. In Parshas Bamidbar, which had been 40 years before, of course it was a different generation, Shimon was a very large tribe. Shimon was 59,300. In Parshas Pinchas, just find it here. In Parshas Pinchas, 22,200. There is no Shevet at all that had such a rapid decrease. Now Rashi says,
so all the others go down though?
Some go down, some go up. The total number is ironically the same, but there's minor adjustments. But Rashi says this could be because a big chunk of this, not all of it, is the 24,000 died in the Magefa. But be it as it may, many, many people were nichshol. Now, one interesting anomaly I want to point out is this. The daughters of Moab don't seem to exhibit a tremendous amount of tzinius here. When Bilam encourages them to be mezana, they go out and they're mezana. Now, we know later, in the book of Devarim, in fact, we learned about this with Rus, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Lo yavo amayni yomayavi b'kal Hashem, a convert of Ammon or Moab, right, which are descendants of Lot, are not allowed to enter the Jewish people because they didn't give you food and water when you were going through the desert, and the pasuk goes on, there's a second reason people forget, and they hired Bilam to curse you. Those are the two reasons. They didn't give you food and water, and they hired Bilam ben Beor to curse you, but Hashem changed the klala of Bilam into halacha. All of us know the halacha, based on the story of Rus, that the prohibition against marrying converts from Ammon or Moab only apply to male converts. It does not apply to female converts, because we darshan mayavi v'loy mayavis Ammoni and not Ammonis, which is why Rus was allowed to marry Klaus. So now the halacha was forgotten. At various times, people raised the issue that Rus was not allowed to marry. That's why the other relative didn't want to marry Rus. When Boaz died, the day that he married Rus, people thought, oh, that's a raya, that there's something wrong. But the bottom line is, the halacha is that it's winter. Now, why is it winter? So the Gemara says the following drasha. The Gemara says, because if Moab is condemned because they didn't offer you food and water, it is only the derech of men to greet an invading army, not foreign people, with food and water. We cannot expect the women to do that, because kol kavuda, quoting the pasuk in Tehillim, kol kavuda bas melech penima, that the dignity and glory of the king's daughter is to be in private. So how can we condemn the Moabite women because of their tremendous tzinius and modesty in not coming out and offering the Jewish people food and water? What's a mudna thing is that how can it be possibly understood that the reason the Moabite women didn't offer food and water was because of Kol Kavudah Batzmah Panima, if in fact when it comes to Zanus and Avodah Zarah, they're in the forefront. So now you invoke Tznias, now they invoke Tznias, says, oh, well, they got the water, that would be a chisaron of Tznias with men after all. So what you see from here is an interesting thing. What you see from here is, you see that hypocrisy does count for something in life. And that is to say, that if what you did is intrinsically a proper mode of behavior, even though your motives are totally corrupt, HaKadosh Baruch Hu considers that as well. Meaning to say, not going out to a foreign nation and bringing them water is inherently a maisa tsanua. That is a behavior that is does constitute tsanias. Was that the motivation of the Moabite women? Absolutely not. They were much more fruitsome than that. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewards them for doing the right thing, or not doing in this case the right thing, even though the motives were totally wrong. It's a little bit of a musr that sometimes we feel we don't want to behave a certain way because we're not on the madrega. It doesn't really correspond to who we are. But what you see from here is that sometimes there's an inyan of taka behaving a certain way that's correct, even if it's not according to the madrega that we're on. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewards that as well. There's a beautiful poet, a famous English essayist and poet, once said that hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. Meaning to say, vice, a person is not such a good person, but he feels, I have to pay a tribute to virtue by behaving a certain way. Now, of course, we don't mean to say to lie or create impressions that one is a tzaddik when they're not, but it means that the notion that your outer behavior has to mirror your inner spiritual resources is not always emes. And of course, the emes is that's really nasa v'nishma as well. And that's what the Sefer HaChinuch says, that a person is influenced by what they do. In other words, the actions change the person, rather than say that the person's inner state is what causes the action. Now, we often say the opposite. If you wait until you have an inner state, you'll never do anything. But the concept is, act and then feel. In fact, I mentioned before, the Malbim says that is actually the meaning, going to a different context, of the Ahavta L'Re'echa Kamocha. You should love your friend as you love yourself. So most of us interpret this as an emotion. We should try to feel love for a person. But the Malbim points out, if the commandment would be emotional, it would say the Ahavta Es Re'echa. Right? The Ahavta Es Hashem Elokecha. You love your friend. La Re'echa, to your friend. The Malbim says, the mitzvah is not to feel, the mitzvah is to behave. The Ahavta means engage in acts of love to your Re'ah. The Torah is not mitzvah initially, at least. Feel, because sometimes you're not going to feel. The Torah says do, even if you don't feel. And then you come to eventually feel as well. Rav Dessler points out, this is also a message for Shalom Bayis. Rav Dessler used to point out, again, it's a very, very well-known thought, I'm sure you've heard it before, that the shorish of Ava is Hav, which is an Aramaic word, actually, for to give. That love comes from the giving and the investment that we have. One of the reasons why parents love children is because all of that they have invested in the children. So you see your children as an extension of you. Which is why we often have the phenomenon that sometimes it's precisely the children that may have given us the greatest difficulty that we feel the strongest attachment to, because we have invested so much. And therefore, v'yahavta l're'echa. So the point I'm making is that in an oblique way, you see this lesson from the Moabite women themselves, whose behavior was not motivated out of any consideration of tznias, but even so, they're given a certain reward of that they're permitted to enter into it. So, in either event, Bilam's strategy was very successful. 24,000 Jews died, and then we have this public fornication of the head of the tribe of Shimon, Zimri ben Solu, that is with Cozbi Basor, a Midianite woman. So that's kind of interesting, because most of the Jewish people were apparently nichshal with Moabite women. But this is a Midianite woman, and Pinchas comes and he kills them publicly. and the Magefa stops. Meaning the plague would have kept on going had Pinchas not taken his position. The Gemara explains that Pinchas acted according to a halacha, but it's a very interesting halacha. It's a halacha that says, and again, one has to understand this, it normally would not apply. You can't, for example, go ahead and kill an intermarried couple for this reason, but it says, Haboel ba'aramis, that if you actually see what we call the flagrante delicto, if you actually see a public intercourse of a Jew and a non-Jew, the halacha is that you can be a vigilante, and you can take the law into your own hands, and you can execute them. That is called a kanoi if you are a zealous person. Now it's very interesting that if you ask a shayla, right, you have your sword, and you go to the rav and say, can I do it? The answer is supposed to be no, not allowed to do it. That's really the idea. The idea is that it has to come from a spontaneity. And if you ask the shayla, you can't do it. Now, it's interesting that while this
might say, that's a law, by the way. A crime of passion.
Well,
get off.
It's also Texas law. I'm in Texas too. A husband can kill. If a husband catches his wife or somebody, yeah, he can just kill them, and it's not a crime. But anyway, so the thing is, but imagine the scene here. People are dying right and left. This person of Shimon is openly flaunting Moshe Rabbeinu and Klal Yisrael, and he's doing things which are, you know, even if it wouldn't be an intermarriage, the whole Misa of doing something again in public is a despicable thing. And people turn to Moshe and they say, Moshe, is this permitted or not? And Moshe says, of course it's not permitted. And the Nasi turns to Moshe and says, so why are you married to Yisro's daughter? She's a Midianite woman. Now, of course, what comparison is that? Tzipora did a geirus, Yisro did a geirus, but Moshe is flabbergasted at the way we would describe it. He doesn't even know what to answer. And people are dying right and left. And Pinchas takes the sword and he kills. So this is the halacha of Boel Ba'aramis Kanai and Paikinba. So what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, remove my name from Israel because he was zealous for me. Therefore, I give him a covenant of peace. Now, everybody knows the first Rashi. It says, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, the son of Aaron. Why say Aaron? You normally don't give a yichus back to the grandfather. So what does Rashi say? Rashi says, because after Pinchas did this act, the Shevatim, the other tribes, were mevazin oso. They were insulting him because they said, hey, Pinchas, you yourself come from an idolatry. Just read the Lashon of Rashi here. Pinchas is described as Ben Puti Zeh. You are the son of a stuffer of animals for idolatry. Shepitein Avi Imo Al Golem Leavodazara. See, this is the interesting thing. Just as Moshe Rabbeinu married a daughter of Yisro, we also have to remember Elazar, Aaron's son, Pinchas' father, Elazar also married another daughter of Yisro, at least according to the simple explanation of Rashi. In other words, Elazar essentially married one of his aunts. And therefore, Pinchas' own mother was a Midianite woman, converted Midianite woman. Of course, it's all kasha. How could a Kohen marry a non-Jew? I mean, Moshe, who's a Levi, could marry a Gioris. Moshe could marry a converted woman. How could Elazar, who is a Kohen, marry a converted woman? Even Bizman Hazeh, a Kohen is not allowed to marry a non-Jewish woman who converted. So there's a whole halachic question. How could Elazar, the Kohen, marry? Again, we have to assume Elazar married before Matan Torah, and therefore, it's kind of a grandfather clause, before Matan Torah, things were permitted. In fact, the emes is, you have to say this even for Moshe Rabbeinu. It's an amazing thing, and you know, I almost feel very disrespectful saying it. But if you consider the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu, Yocheved, and Amram were aunt and nephew, because Yocheved was a daughter of Levi, And Amram was the son of Gahas, who was the son of Levi. So Gahas and Yocheved are brother and sister. Amram is therefore a nephew and an aunt. It was technically Achos Aviv. It was the sister of Amram's father. Achos Aviv is one of the Arayos in the Torah. If a nephew marries his father's sister, the child is not an incestuous marriage. The child is a mamzer. It happens not to be the other way. It's asymmetrical. A niece is allowed to marry an uncle. In fact, when many Hasidim, we sometimes have that. But a nephew cannot marry an aunt, either a father's sister or a mother's sister. So the emes is, had the marriages occurred after Matan Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu himself would not have been allowed to marry into Klal Yisrael. Of course, ironically, he would have been allowed to marry a Gioris, because a mamzer can marry a Gioris. So if Moshe Rabbeinu had actually worked out well, but I guess the same thing is going to be. But Aaron, again, it's not only a problem with Moshe Rabbeinu, it's a problem with Aaron, it's a problem with Miriam. So obviously we're dealing with the fact that Kodem Matan Torah, different relationships were permitted that would later become Usher. But in either event, what do we have here? Elazar married a Midianite woman. So Pinchas' own grandfather is an Oved Avodah, or was an Oved Avodah Zarah. So people looked at Pinchas and says, "Hey Pinchas, what gives you the right to be the from one here? Your grandfather, Avi Ima, the father of your mother, was Mefate Magolim Le'Avodah Zarah. He would fatten up calves Le'Avodah Zarah." So the Torah says, okay, don't look at Pinchas' Yichas from his mother. Look at Pinchas' Yichas from his father, Ben Aaron HaKohen. Now, here's the question. The question is, that's an evasive answer. What does Rashi mean? In other words, if the accusation against Pinchas is, Pinchas, from your mother's side, you come from an Oved Avodah Zarah. So why are you such a tzaddik? So we answer, yes, but from his father's side, he comes from Aaron the Kohen Gadol. But that doesn't negate the fact that he comes from Oved Avodah Zarah. And besides, Aaron himself has somewhat of the taints of Oved Avodah Zarah because of his participation in the sin of the golden calf, the Chet HaEgel. So, how do you answer this? In other words, this is not an answer. In other words, if there is some criticism that somehow Pinchas is tainted because he comes from this Yichus of Avodah Zarah, that is not negated by pointing to something else. So here, the Ksav Sofer says, in a very nice explanation, the Ksav Sofer says that we're not simply dealing with family accusations where I say, hey, Pinchas, you have a black mark, and Pinchas's answer is, okay, look at my white mark. In other words, it's not simply that. But rather, the Shevatim are attacking his right to be a Kanoi. Because in order to be a Kanoi, one has to act the Shem Shemayim for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One cannot be a Kanoi because he gets angry. One cannot be a Kanoi because of a personal agenda. One cannot be a Kanoi if one wants to build up their reputation as a zealous, conscientious person. And there are in the world people who are hotheads. There are in the world people who are bad temper. And what the Shevatim are saying to Pinchas is, Pinchas, you acted because you come from Avodah Zarah. And because you come from Avodah Zarah, you may have acted out of a personal need to establish your credentials in the community. What's wrong with that? Because kanos involves murder. Now the emes is the following. If your kavana is totally pure, if it's totally l'shem shemayim, then it becomes an act of kedusha. But if there's any personal agenda in it whatsoever, it becomes tainted as an aveira of ritzicha. And they're pointing out, Pinchas, your agenda was personal. Because since you yourself come from Oved Avodah Zarah, right, you can imagine the situation. What better way does a person establish that he's made it by, you know, actively destroying that thing from which he came? But the problem is, that's not true kanos. That is not zealousness for Hashem. That is zealousness for you. Your self-aggrandizement, the building up of your ego, and that taints the whole kanos. And therefore, In other words, you're acting in furtherance of your own personal needs. By the Torah saying, Pinchas is a grandson of Aaron. In fact, the real way you translate it according to the Ksav Sefer is, you don't read it, Pinchas, the son of Elazar, who is the son of Aaron, which is the genealogical way. The way you read it is, Pinchas is the son of Elazar, and Pinchas, on a spiritual level, is the son of Aaron. Aaron's characteristic was the lover of peace, the pursuer of peace. Pinchas did not act because he wanted the violence. It's the opposite. Pinchas hated what he was doing with every fiber of his being, but he did it because it had to be done. In other words, the true kanoi has to hate being a kanoi. The true kanoi does not enjoy tearing people down. The true kanoi feels pain when Jews are not keeping the mitzvahs. It is both the pain of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the pain of a fellow Jew that is not realizing their potential. The Torah is made that Pinchas acted not because that was his nature, but Pinchas acted in spite of the fact that this was connected his nature. You see, that's why the Torah connects him to Aaron. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to say, very, very beautifully, that how do you tell the difference between one who is really a kanoi entitled to be a zealot and one that is a fake kanoi? Right, that's right. He compared it to the cats. Let's say a woman has a mice-infested house. So she buys a cat to kill the mice. Right, in Yerushalayim, so you always have all these feral cats after a few generations, whatever. Rav Chaim says, on one level, the housewife and the cat share a common agenda. They both hope there'll be a lot, the mice will be caught. But the difference is, the cat hopes there'll be mice that it can rip apart. The housewife or the woman would much prefer there be no mice. And it's rather than have the mice. And it says, a true kanoi does not get joy in exposing people's shortcomings. Does not get joy in having to demonstrate or throw rocks or whatever it might be. What needs to be done sometimes needs to be done to address Chilul Hashem, and then you do it. But there is no joy there. The false kanoi loves opportunities to expose other people's chasronos and to tear their dam and to be mevatel them, and they would be sad, they would be upset if there'd be nothing for them to attack. Because of course, when there's nothing out there to attack, one has to focus inward on one's own chasronos, and that's much more difficult to do. And we much more enjoy, all of us very often, much more enjoy thinking about, either thinking about, exposing, talking about, whatever form it takes. Whether it involves action, whether it involves Lashon Hara, or even if we're beyond that, even if Baruch Hashem we don't do actions or Lashon Hara, but at least we can think about the chisronos of others. And that way we don't have to think about ourselves. So Rav Chaim says the big question we have to ask when we oppose movements against Torah is, are we the housewife or are we the cat? Do we like finding things wrong so we can expose them and not look into ourselves? And therefore the Ksav Sefer says that's the inner meaning of Ben Aaron. The Torah is made that Pinchas did not behave because he liked exposing people's chasronos. It's the opposite. Pinchas was a Ben Aharon HaKohen, one who was a lover of peace, a pursuer of peace. This was not his nature. This was against his nature. And that's why it became a Kiddush Hashem. Because Pinchas did what he had to do, although it was totally against his character, which was one of a lover of peace. Now the emes is, again, this is a little difficult to say, but it is a thought that Mefarshim say, that you do see how dangerous kanos is. The Aruch Chaim says in a different context, the pasuk, "V'nasan lecha rachamim v'richamecha." It's a pasuk that says, if you keep Hashem's commandments, He will give you mercy. V'richamecha, He will show you mercy. So the Aruch Chaim says, what is the double? It's the same thing. So it's two different things, he says. The Aruch Chaim says that He will show you mercy means Hashem will give you success. But the other problem is this. When a person has to wage war and kill out nations, even if it's a mitzvah, there's a tremendous risk that your character will become cruel and callous. And Hashem gave Bnei Yisrael a special promise. B'nasa l'cha rachamim doesn't mean Hashem will show you mercy. But Hashem will continue to give you the capacity to have mercy, even when you're engaged in acts of cruelty, if you do it l'shem Hashem. But you see the Aruch Chaim's points. The Aruch Chaim's point is, it's like the reversal of the Sefer HaChinuch's point. Just like we say a person is influenced by their good actions, so too, the actions that involve cruelty and destruction, even when they are warranted, could be mashpia on a person without a special divine assistance. It could influence a person to become cruel and unfeeling. And the emesis, the Mephoshim point out, that we do see that the kanos of Pinchas, which was motivated totally the Shem Hashem, and Pinchas was a Ben Aaron HaKohen, eventually on some small level, which is really beyond our comprehension, but on some small level, turned into a certain degree, again, very, very dacus, very, very small, but a certain degree of indifference towards others. We see this. Remember, Pinchas eventually metamorphized into Eliyahu HaNavi. Pinchas lived forever. Pinchas Eliyahu. Now, what do we find? We find a few things.
Could you go back?
Yeah.
Could you just...
You never heard that? Oh, okay. We say that Pinchas the Kohen actually never died.
And I heard.
And Pinchas is the person that is later known to us as Eliyahu HaNavi. Pinchas is Eliyahu. In fact, there's a whole story about that, a little story. If you know that, in back of the Kaisel, when you're in the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeisim, so right up against the back wall, there is a gate that is closed, a gate in the old wall of the city. It's called the Golden Gate, Shar HaZav. And there's an Arab cemetery on the slope right behind that gate. You see that. And the story goes, because there is a Masorah, that Eliyahu HaNavi is going to enter the Beis HaMikdash through that gate. The Arabs know the tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi is a Kohen, and they know that a Kohen is not allowed to walk through a cemetery. So they built the Arabs are very good at midrashim. Oh yes, it was intentional. They intentionally put a cemetery by the Golden Gate, because they figured if they could prevent Eliyahu HaNavi from going through that gate, Mashiach is not going to come.
But this is like standard.
It's a very well known medrash that Pinchas is Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, the thing is that the Arabs get it wrong. It's kind of like these cartoon characters. They're always trying to figure out some way.
A spy be a spy.
Right. And it never works. Because first of all, Eliyahu HaNavi could fly. If he can come in that way. But second of all, the halakha is that a Kohen is allowed to walk through a non-Jewish cemetery. So therefore, there is no Israel. So they don't have it right. But okay. But in any event, this is well known. Now, we know with Eliyahu HaNavi, a few things. First of all, we know, actually, when he was still called Pinchas, there's a Maisa. If you remember the famous Maisa with Yiftach. Remember, Yiftach was one of the Shoftim, and Yiftach made that very difficult vow that the first thing that comes out of his house, he will bring as a korban for Hashem after his victory over Midian. And his daughter comes out to greet him. Now, the truth is, there's a big, big machlokas. The psukim are not very clear exactly what happens. You know, it doesn't want to say almost. Some Mephoshim actually say she was brought as a korban. An amazing thing. Other Mephoshim say that the way he fulfilled the vow was that she became like a nun. She never married and she lived in isolation. And she devoted her life, as it were, to serving Hashem privately. And that's why it mentions every year. See, it all depends. The Pasuk says every year the Benos Yisrael came to cry with Yiftach's daughter. So the Rabbanel says that literally means with Yiftach's daughter. In other words, she was alive. Others say she was killed. Now, the point is this. The point is, it's absolutely the case that there's no such thing as a vow. Even if you would have made a vow specifically, I will bring my daughter as a korban. That vow is nothing. That's null and void. You can't make a vow to kill a human being. And Pinchas was the Nasi of that generation. And Pinchas could have very easily have paskened in. Because Yiftach felt he needed a definitive psak from the leader of the generation. But Pinchas said, well, if Yiftach needs me, you ought to come to me. And Yiftach said, well, you know, I'm the shofa, I'm the leader of the generation. Pinchas should come to me. And Chazal say, it's an amazing thing, because neither person wanted to be the first one to take the initiative. So Yiftach's daughter was either killed or whatever happened. So already you see that the notion of Chazal turned into perhaps a certain toughness, which may lead to negative things. In fact, there was a very, very big aveira on both of their parts. The other example we see is already when Pinchas is called Eliyahu HaNavi. If you remember, Eliyahu HaNavi is dealing mainly with Malchi Yisrael. His main antagonist is Achav. Eliyahu comes and is the whole Maisa at Har Carmel, the Maisa of the Mizbeach, right? Remember, the prophets of the Baal built an altar, and Eliyahu builds an altar, and Eliyahu covers his altar with water, soggy water, the wood gets soggy, and Eish comes min HaShamayim and consumes. And everybody says, Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim. So there's mass tshuva. Eliyahu HaNavi feels at that moment, finally they see the message. Finally, you know, they're turning away from this idolatry. Finally, they're learning what I tried to tell them. Well, Achav gives Eliyahu HaNavi one day, the rest of the day, to savor his experience. And the next day he says to Eliyahu, if I ever see you again, I'm going to kill you. You know, there's the whole thing. Mount Carmel, the experience of Mount Carmel lasted exactly one day. They went back to him. And Eliyahu HaNavi is totally embittered, because now he says, what more could I do? I've done everything I can do. And he makes a famous plea to Hashem, in which he uses the same words. In fact, this is actually the Midrashic Remes, why Pinchas is Eliyahu. Pinchas is described as Bikanois Kinosi. He was zealous for my cause. Eliyahu HaNavi uses those same words. Kano Kinesi Lashem. I have been zealous for you, Hashem. And what has happened? And he says, these people don't learn from anything. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically, if you read, basically fires Eliyahu at that moment. HaKadosh Baruch Hu basically, that's the famous thing, Hashem, there's a fire, and it says the Hashem was not in the fire, and there's an earthquake, and Hashem was not in the earthquake. And then there's a cold mamadaka, a very small voice, and Hashem was in that small voice. And again, part of the message here is that Eliyahu, don't think you're going to reach people by fire and brimstone and even miracles. You reach people by the direct connection you have with them, the quiet moments of sharing. That's how you reach people. And if you look, what was the message Hashem gave Eliyahu directly? Go anoint your successor, Elisha. Essentially, he fired him. You're not in this world anymore. It is time to get a successor. When you feel that the Jewish people are beyond redemption, you cannot function as a Jewish leader anymore. Going back, according to Menachem, that is why Moshe Rabbeinu, it was decreed that he would not be able to enter the land, because he called them rebellious ones, because he was angry momentarily. I mean, the concept is, ad kedei kach, that if there's a single moment that the leader loses faith in his people, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you can't be the leader anymore. You have to have emunah. And in fact, you know, Chazal say, Eliyahu HaNavi was punished, in a way. Because Eliyahu HaNavi argued, the Jewish people have no faith. The Jewish people have abandoned you. The Jewish people are no good. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu decreed, Eliyahu HaNavi, you have to attend the two ceremonies that almost every Jew does, even if they're not such a good Jew. And that's the Bris Milah. Most Jews have boys, they give them a Bris, and the Pesach Seder. So the reason Eliyahu HaNavi goes to every Bris and every Seder is this was initially kind of a punishment, not so much a punishment, but to show Eliyahu HaNavi that the Jewish people do have faith, even if it's attenuated. The point I'm making is that, in a sense, based on these chazals, in a sense you see that Kanos is a dangerous street that it takes us down, that sometimes it is very justified. but it can implant in us a certain degree. Again, we can't judge the tzaddikim, but a certain degree of a callousness, a lack of concern, a feeling of people not being worthy. Just as the Orach Chaim says, that even in killing the seven nations of Canaan, without special siyata d'shmaya, a person could develop a certain sense of cruelty and the like. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz made this point again in yet another context, and he makes the point that when you hurt another human being, he says, even if it's justifiable for whatever reason, he says it's like putting your hands in fire. There's going to be a cost to you. Sometimes you have to take that cost. For example, a baby falls into a fire, you rush in and save it. Of course, that's the right thing to do. But your hand is still going to be burnt. Unless you're someone that's roy for an ace niggler, the fact that it's just as Rav Chaim says, every time we hurt another person, every time we disparage another person, there is some consequence that we're going to suffer. Even though, and we can't give a teretz, it's l'shem shamayim, it was good. Maybe so. But there's going to be that. There's going to be that cost. You can't not cause. You can't cause pain to other people and get away with it totally. There's going to be something in the neshama. He brings a raya, of course. What Chazal say? Chazal say by Megillah. It says by Haman's Gezeh, when Haman made his decree, by Yisak Za'aka Tadol Umara, Mordechai had a bitter, loud cry. That's the same lashon Torah records when Esav discovers that Yaakov took the brachas. And Chazal say, because of the tears that Yaakov caused Esav, Haman, who is descended from Esav, the Amalek, elicits the same tzar. Yaakov did what he did, that was the future of all Israel, that was the way it had to be. So what? But when there's pain and suffering in the world, it's going to come back. And you can't escape it. So that's why the idea of kanos is a very, very difficult and delicate area for a lot of reasons. Are the motivations l'shem shemayim? Are we doing the least amount of pain that we can do? Will it give us attributes of cruelty or arrogance? Will it prevent us from looking into our own chesronos? Right? It's always easier, particularly during 3 weeks, we think about not having geula, not being redeemed, etc. So one of the things we have to think about is why isn't Mashiach here? And it's very easy. Well, Mashiach isn't here because of what A, B, and C are doing to be ma'akev the geula, instead of looking at ourselves. And the fact that Pinchas acted not out of hate, Pinchas acted out of love, because remember, people are dying. It was Pinchas that saved Bnei Yisrael. And that is why Pinchas could be given the blessing of Shalom. How could an act of war give you a blessing of peace unless your motive was to bring Shalom? Now, what is the Bris Shalom? What does it mean? I give Pinchas, like Rashi says, Hineni nosein lo es brisi shalom. I give Pinchas a covenant of peace. What exactly is the covenant of peace? So Rashi makes a point. Rashi gives a halakhic point that Pinchas did not become a Kohen until he did this. Pinchas is born from a Kohen. So he says, no, it's not automatic. You see, Aaron and Elazar did not become Kohanim until they were anointed with Shemen HaMishkan. They're the first Kohanim. They're anointed with special oil. So once somebody is a Kohen, any children they have after that point are going to be Kohanim. But Pinchas was born before his father Elazar was anointed with the oil. So Pinchas had the status of a pre-Kohen child. And therefore, Pinchas got the bracha of Shalom, the bracha being, as it were, an emissary of Hashem to bring peace into the world, only after he killed Zimri, which is very interesting, because I think I heard everyone going over this halacha, that there is a halacha that even applies today for duchenim, that if a Kohen kills somebody, he's not allowed to duchen. And Hashem says, those who have hands cannot serve me. Many opinions say, even if a Kohen did it accidentally, this would be no gay duchenim and the like. So how could Pinchas, as it were, be a Kohen if he was Harages HaNefesh? Part of the answer is, though, Pinchas didn't become a Kohen until after this mindset. and therefore there's no particular problem. But nevertheless, Pinchas, as we say, did metamorphize into Eliyahu, and Eliyahu will be the one that will bring, that will announce the coming of the Mashiach. I want to go on to a different topic, though. This is the first part, but I just want to finish one little ha'ara about the 3 weeks that is actually connected to this idea of Kanos. That is, Rav Tzadok points out, and again, it's obviously very clear from the calendar, that Shivas or B'Tamuz is, of course, the same day of the week as Tisha B'Av. Like, it's exactly 3 weeks later. But if you think about it, Shivas or B'Tamuz is also the same day of the week as the first day of Pesach. It all happens to be the same, just counting it. And he says that this teaches us, in effect, that there is a linkage between Pesach and Shivas or B'Tamuz. Why is that? So he says the linkage is very simple. What should have happened on Shivas or B'Tamuz? What should have happened was Moshe Rabbeinu would be coming down on the 40th day from Matan Torah with the Luchos. Now, if the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was Matan Torah, well, of course, Shavuos is Matan Torah, but in effect, we only heard the Aseres HaDibros on Shavuos. The Torah coming down as a whole would have been on Shivas or B'Tamuz. Not as a whole, because actually, I mean, obviously,
X amount of days after.
Yeah, 40 days. In other words, on Shavuos, Moshe Rabbeinu went up on Har Sinai, and he was there for 40 days. The 40th day from Shavuos is the 17th of Tammuz. In fact, that's why they built the Egel, because they knew Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to come down the 40th day, and they thought, because there were clouds and everything, they thought it was already more than half the day. Like the sun and the clouds and everything else. Which means, therefore, Rav Tzadok says, in the world that should have been, that wasn't, in the world that should have been, Shivas or B'Tamuz would have been the culmination of Pesach. Because that would have been when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down, when Moshe Rabbeinu comes down with the Torah. However, in the world as it became, and not the ideal world, those luchos were broken and destroyed. But nevertheless, the connection continues. Because losing the luchos initiated a process of introspection and tshuva, which eventually leads to all the way to Yom Kippur, in which we get the second luchos again. People often don't look at Yom Kippur this way, but Yom Kippur is very much a day of Kabbalas HaTorah. Moshe Rabbeinu came down with the second luchos on Yom Kippur. In fact, the reason Yom Kippur is a day of forgiveness is because that is the day that Hashem forgave the Chet HaEgel by allowing Moshe to bring down the luchos. So Rav Tzadok points out, therefore, that although Shivas or B'Tamuz is no longer associated with Kabbalah HaTorah because the luchos were broken, in effect it is still connected because it initiates the process of tshuva through which we eventually merit the Torah. Meaning, the Ikar Avodah of 3 weeks is to be cognizant of loss. But by being cognizant of loss, you come to tshuva. Right? In other words, the concept is not to cry over spilled milk. The concept is to recognize what we're losing and then come to tshuva. So Rav Tzadok says there's still a linkage, therefore, between Pesach, Shivas or B'Tamuz, etc. Then he goes on and says, very beautifully, that the 3 weeks correspond to the attempt to liberate ourselves from the three enslavers that cause chet, kina, jealousy, lust, and kavod. And that corresponds, again, connecting it to Pesach, that corresponds to three of the four languages of redemption. Vahutzeisi, I will take you out. Vihitzalti, I will save you. Vigaalti, I will redeem you. That refers to kina, taiva, v'kavod. In other words, God will take us out of that. Tisha B'Av, he says, this is an amazing thing. What is the ninth of Av, which comes after 3 weeks? That corresponds to the fourth lashon of redemption. I will take you unto me as a people. That Tisha B'Av is a day, in a sense, where we're very close to Hashem, because we share Hashem's pain. at the distance that we have. It's a paradoxical notion. But sometimes when people grieve together, that is when they are closest. And Tisha B'Av is when we join with HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Avelis. And that's why it's called a Moed, a day of assembly, a day of connection. That's what a Moed is. So you hear what Rav Tzedek says. Rav Tzedek is saying that the 3 weeks corresponds to Hashem helping us surmount the enslavers, Kinataiva V'Kavod, corresponding to the 3 Lashonos of Geula. And ironically, Tisha B'Av is the 4th Geula, the Lakachti Eschem Liliyon. In fact, it was very moving. This is really a book that every person should read. The book, The Holy Fire. This is by the last Rebbe in the Warsaw Ghetto of Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, the Piazetzler Rebbe, who was a very, very, very remarkable figure in many ways. Even before the war, he was a tremendously gifted person in terms of education. He wrote Kovas Kalmidim books about how young people should be educated and how one grows in Avodas Hashem, and it shouldn't just be information. But in the Warsaw Ghetto, he was the one that continued to teach and speak and give shiurim. And we have writings of his that are from the ghetto. They were assembled in the Sefer Eish Kodesh that were buried in the ghetto and were retrieved afterward. And things like, he would write, you know, today I lost my son. Again, you know, the famous thought that Purim is called Yom Kippur, Yom Kippur is a day like Purim. What's the connection? So he said, just like on Yom Kippur, you have to fast whether you feel like it or not. Purim, you have to rejoice whether you feel like it or not. And, you know, his whole life was given to trying to give people that encouragement. And, you know, if you read it, though, you see that you get a sense of his struggle. You get a sense that as time was going on, it was harder and harder to understand what was, you know, when things started, well, you know, this is an Einesh, we do tshuva, and Hashem will, you know, save us. But it didn't seem to end. 40, 41, 42, 43, there was no end in sight. What was happening here? So, The normal explanations that you say for Tzoras were beyond, you know, you couldn't say the normal things. So, in his Svarim, he developed this idea. He said, the war of the Nazis, which was Amalek, they are Amalek, was a war really against HaKadosh Baruch, which was not against the Jews only. It was against Hashem. They wanted to destroy Hashem from the world. And it's precisely because the Jewish people are so close to Hashem that they share in the sufferings of the Shechina. The sufferings of the Shechina, just as God is beyond our comprehension, the sufferings of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are beyond human comprehension. And he says it was the schus of Klal Yisrael that Hashem chose us to bear the suffering of the Shechina. So he says in this way, he said he saw this as a privilege to be with Hashem in that suffering. And this is, you know, again, it's something that we couldn't say, we were not in it, we don't have the right to talk that way. But this, I'm just quoting really what he talked about. So, an adaptation of his thing in the book, The Holy Fire, it's not a translation, but there are lengthy excerpts that were translated from books. So you get that idea of the notion that the suffering of the Jew is bound up with the suffering of Hashem. And therefore, we suffer because we are Hashem's nation. And therefore, when there's... That's right, it's the opposite of Christianity. It's not that God suffers through us, but rather we suffer with Hashem. And he talked about the fact that he quotes a medrash. Again, it's a well-known medrash, but it's an amazing medrash, where when HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and sent the Jewish people in exile, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to cry. And the Malachi Asharis told HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're not going to let you cry. And Hashem said, if you don't let me cry, I will go to a room where you cannot follow me. And there I will cry. And he explains that what's going on is this, is as the pain that Hashem feels when the Jewish people suffer is such an infinite pain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kavyachol cannot go on. So the world can't exist. In other words, imagine this in human terms. Imagine somebody, someone becomes widowed, but they have small children. The pain can be so overwhelming that they can't go on. But if they can't go on, what's going to happen to the children? What's going to happen? The world is going to fall apart. Kavyachol, he says, and it's a very anthropomorphic picture, so again, we can't fully understand it, but he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's pain could not allow the sun to go on, could not allow the moon, could not allow the sky, the world would fall apart. And that's what the angels are telling Hashem. The angels are telling Hashem, you have to be strong for this world. You cannot fall apart. And Hashem says, you're right. I will go into a private place and I will keep my pain within me in order that the world will be able to go on. That's how he interprets the Medrash. I will go into a room where you cannot follow me. Imagine the widow shutting the bedroom door to cry because she doesn't want the world of the children to be totally destroyed. Again, obviously, we can't describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu totally in this human picture, but I'm quoting the way the Rebbe understood, tried to explain.
But if he sees the private room.
The private room means HaKadosh Baruch Hu is alone with his pain. That's what he says. And Hashem does not, in other words, Hashem allows the world to go on, because the world has to go on. He doesn't, in other words, he basically said, he wondered in his writings, why is there still such a sky? Why isn't this world just being destroyed from this evil? And he says, that's the good. In fact, I'll go back to a Chazal. Chazal made the point that at the time of the Bayis Sheni, the leadership of the Jewish people was in what was called the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the great assembly. Ezra, 120 elders, Mordechai. Why was it called Anshei Knesset HaGdolah? Because they returned a certain phrase in Shemona Esrei that had been dropped. Moshe Rabbeinu described Hashem in the Torah as Kel HaGadol, the great God, Gibor, mighty, Nora, awesome. But Yirmiyahu deleted Gibor, because Yirmiyahu said, when Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, where was God's might? He chose not to show it. But the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah said, that itself was the greatest Gibor, to hold himself in for whatever reason, and let the Umos do their thing, but not destroy the world. That's an act of Gibor too. Inner strength, holding in for whatever reason, is an ultimate Gibor. I'm trying to remember. I was connecting to Rapsodic. So that's the idea. So the idea is that sometimes the pain that we feel because of ghosts is a sign of our closeness to Hashem. So that's the connection. So the 3 weeks, Kina Taiva Vekavot, but Tisha B'Av is the fourth language of redemption. You are my nation. Because you feel the suffering that I feel.
But how do you reconcile that with the idea of Hester Pagan? The ever presence, but the hiding face.
Yes. Well, that's exactly
it. Is that just a different way of looking at it?
Well, it's a different way, but on a deeper level, they are unified and so on. That is, there is the pain of knowing how much Hashem wants to be with us, but knowing that we have this distance and we have this machitza. But ironically, being aware of the pain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu feels because of this distance creates a tremendous sense of closeness. In other words, it is the closest of knowing how much the distance is painful, which creates a closeness.
Well, it does. I know my mother and her friends, they make a joke of it. They say, well, I guess God was sleeping. I mean, that's their way of dealing with it. That is actually something of a joke.
How do you deal with it?
It's
just an amazing thing. But to read the book of someone who's writing this as it was being experienced, is a tremendously meaningful thing. So this is Rav Tzadok's point. So there is a connection, again, just to summarize, between Shiva, Surba, Tammuz, and Pesach. They are the same day of the week. Shiva, Surba, Tammuz would have been the Yom of Kabbalah Satorah, or at least, you know, the Luchos coming down. Instead, it turned into the beginning of a process of Golos, of Merchak, but it leads to introspection and Shuva, culminating in Yom Kippur. Then he talked about the 3 weeks as dealing with the three enslavers of Kina, Taiva, Bekavot, which corresponds to the three Lashonas of redemption. And Tisha B'Av, ironically, is when we are the nation of Hashem. And that was, I've read in the P.S.S. the Rebbe's remarks, that it is feeling the pain that somehow marks us as the nation of Hashem. And it's very, very clear, by the way, that Nazism was not just, and I always differentiate my own mind, let's say, the PLO from the Nazis. It's very, very different. The PLO, obviously, are not good people, and they want all of Eretz Yisrael. But, you know, if every Jew in the world would decide, let's move to Borough Park, let them have Eretz Yisrael, presumably they would leave us alone. I mean, they're not against Jews. They're not against, you know, you can daven, you can put on tefillin, you can do what you want. Just get out of Eretz Yisrael, which is an evil thing. But with Hitler, that wasn't the same. You know, you didn't care. You could have gone to the North Pole. They would search you out. They would look for you. Because it was a war against Hashem. Which is why, by the way, that Nazism had a fascination with Judaism. Just the way someone is... In fact, part of it is they were attracted to it. They knew a lot about Jewish holidays, which is why they used to arrange executions, Bedafka, on Yom Tovim. The last words of some of the people who were hung at Nuremberg was, because they happened to be at Purim, says, Purim 1945. I mean, they were thinking about this. There was a sordid, perverse fascination with Judaism, because that was the enemy. That's what they wanted to destroy. And as is often the case, we are attracted to that which repulses us.
Wasn't the Crusades like that, though? I mean, with the debates and there was a hatred of Torah and Judaism.
I think to some degree. On the other hand, very, very often.
I mean, you could convert and save yourself, but they hated the Jew, qua Jew.
They hated the Jew, but on the other hand, they liked to have the Jew around. The Jew was a money lender. Remember, Catholics didn't lend for interest, Jews lend. The Jew was a scapegoat. In other words, they wanted the Jews to know they were hated. They wanted the Jews to know they were hated, but they wanted the Jews to be around. Just like people even say today, sometimes you have bigots that only want Jewish lawyers. So the concept was, I want that Jewish lawyer, and he knows how to. So there was a concept like that. So it wasn't the same. I mean, what's frightening is there are groups in America which are neo-Nazi groups, which actually talk about hunting down Jews. But it is a war. Well, the pasuk says, "Mochama Lashem ba'amalek." It is a war against Hashem. And the P.S.S. the Rebbe says, "We suffer precisely because we are the Am Hashem. We are Hashem's children." And therefore, we feel the suffering of the Shechina in some way, which is infinitely greater than our suffering. So, in fact, the Sifrei Hasidus say, it says in Megillas Eicha, "Kol rodfeha hisiguha bein hamitzarim," which literally means, "All who chase after her, Yerushalayim, catch her between the narrow walls." In other words, they're trapped in narrow straits. Now we know that the period of 3 weeks is called Bein HaMitzarim. So it means call Rodfei Ka. This is a Hasidic Shavuot. Rodfei Ka, those who pursue God, the Shechina, Hisiguha, will capture it. Bein HaMitzarim. That Bein HaMitzarim is a time for the closeness of Hashem. But it's a complicated closeness, because it is the closeness that comes from an awareness of distance. And often we find that that closeness can be a much more intense closeness. Because when there is actual closeness, there is sometimes a taking for granted. When there is the closeness coming from the feeling of absence. In fact, that's actually Rachel and Leah. Again, going to all sorts of imagery here. Leah had the closeness of Yaakov, which comes from closeness. Leah was married, you know, first. Leah had plenty of children. Presumably she had to talk to Yaakov about how to raise the kids, etc. Leah's buried next to Yaakov in Maris and Machpelah. Rachel represents kind of a stronger, more intense love, but it's a love of the closeness that comes from the distance between them. There was always a certain distance on some level. They were not buried together again. So that's why it says Rachel represents the idea of the love of Hashem in Golos, and Leah represents the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is based on Mikdash in marriage Israel. And of course, part of the difficult avodah of a person is, number one, to feel closeness and distance, and then don't take it for granted when there's eventually closeness. In fact, that's, again, this explains so many things. The Makam Shabali Tshuva, why is the Baal Tshuva on a higher level? Because the Baal Tshuva comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu out of a yearning that is generated from distance. And the yearning that is generated from distance creates a greater passion and a greater desire to be close than somebody who takes things for granted because that's the way they always were. It comes from the same thing. Okay, so that was, sorry, what time do you see?
12:12.
I'm not?
No,
that
after
12. Okay, maybe this is a relatively good place to stop. Okay, and I'll leave you. Okay, have a good week, and I hope 3 weeks will be productive for us.